Okay, so I hopefully convinced you in the with the sermon before lunch that it's interesting to think about that we should try to discover some new interesting kind of question to ask on the space where amplitudes and or the wave function of the universe actually live. And that seems to be a rather arid, boring place on the face of it. It's just the space of, let's say, null momenta if we're talking about scattering amplitudes, or even more boringly, apparently, just the space of configuration, the three-dimensional vectors that add up to zero by momentum conservation for the wave function of the universe. I remind you, the analog of that boundary in anti-de Sitter space is a full, healthy space-time with a notion of locality and a notion of time. So if you hand a physicist a space that looks like that, they know what to do. They ask about correlation functions of a local theory that lives on that space. But now we're talking about the boundary infinity in Minkowski space, the boundary and infinity in cosmology. And neither one of these cases do we have a notion of locality, do we have a notion of time. Just to recap quickly what I said at the end of the last lecture, this is a very important point. It's a qualitative point that this is not something we can hope to derive from some first principles starting from local quantum field theory. At least people tried to do that for a decade in the 60s and they failed. In other words, you could say, let's do the following to figure out what these rules are. Let's take local quantum field theory, study it, and see what, for example, for scattering amplitudes, what the analytic properties of the S matrix actually are, what the analyticity properties are, just from studying Feynman diagrams. And then pretend we didn't do it and declare that those are our rules and see if we can discover those theories, maybe even other theories which have the same, satisfy the same rules without so manifestly having a Lagrangian or something like that. That was essentially the strategy of the S matrix theories of the 60s. And I think this is summarized in this book called The Analytic S Matrix, which I shouldn't say this, but see, now I'm recorded, I can't say it. Never mind. It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book that you should all spend a huge amount of time reading. But I can say the one slightly nasty thing I'll say is anyone who's been even a TA, as many of you will eventually be in your careers as an academic, never mind eventually professor, knows what happens when you grade an exam of a student who's running out of time at the end, and then they just say everything they know, hoping something will be relevant, okay? That's what this book is like, okay? That's what this book is like. The latter chapters of the book is we looked at this, we looked at that, and every time some new interesting phenomenon happens, no general picture in sight. And so the bottom line is the analytic structure of the S matrix, even for 2-to-2 scattering, even in perturbation theory, is extraordinarily delicate, confusing, and they certainly didn't sort out. So if you thought that you're going to responsibly derive from local evolution, blah, blah, what the analytic properties of the S matrix are, then there's no reason to think that we'll succeed when these people didn't succeed 10 years ago. So what's new in this business? What's new in this business now? Well, what's conceptually new? I mean, there's a lot that's technically new. We know much more. We have much more theoretical data. We're focusing on more interesting theories. We have many more, the ability to calculate lots more things, look at patterns, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all true, and they're very, very important. Conceptually, the biggest difference is that, at least in my own view, and certainly what I'm trying to do, is the opposite of what they're trying to do in the 60s, the absolute opposite. The philosophy is the opposite. Not to slavishly be responsible, a good girl guide or boy scout, put on your cap and derive things from causality, but to be the opposite, to guess something, to guess some structure, to guess some new kind of question on this space that produces rich and interesting answers out of which we can see that causality and unitarity emerge. So rather than slavishly derive them, we want to see them come out the other end from some more primitive kind of a question. Okay, so that's the strategy. And as I said at the end of last time, you should, you know, buckle in, put on your seatbelts. There's no rules here. We're going to invent things along as we go along. We're going to try this. We're going to try that. That's just the nature of the business, you know. But as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to do physics, you might as well do something risky. Otherwise, you could do other things. But anyway, that's fine. So that's what we're looking to do. What we're looking to do is to find structures in the space of on-shell momenta and in the space of just, three-dimensional vectors up to momentum conservation, and ask in those spaces some interesting new kinds of mathematical questions and see how locality and unitarity come out of them. Now let me, before showing you some concrete examples of how that happens, let me explain a little about these first words. So we're going to switch gears entirely and just talk about some very simple mathematical ideas. And then we'll see how these things are connected to each other. So totally forget about physics. And I want to tell you about positive geometries. Positive geometries are the generalization of very simple and familiar geometric objects, like the inside of an interval. That's the simplest case, the one-dimensional inside of an interval. So I have two points that are boundary of two points, A and B, and there's the interior. I can go to higher dimensions. I can look at the inside of a triangle or the inside of a tetrahedron. Okay? So these are sort of generalized simplices. These are very familiar things. Already in two dimensions, I can also talk about generalizations. I can talk about a polygon. I could talk about more general polytopes in three dimensions and higher dimensional generalizations. So these things are in general called polytopes. And these are the simplest examples of what we're calling positive geometries. But let me already illustrate what some of the ideas are here. So as you can see, these are what's important about these pictures is that all of these things are some compact region in some space. In this case, they're just I've drawn it like it lives in Euclidean space. Although nowhere in this entire discussion are we going to use any notion of a distance. So every time you're doing geometry without any notion of a distance, it's best thought of in projective terms. So I'll be a little more specific about that for a second. But anyway, there's no notion of distance here. But I can draw these. These pictures. There are some compact regions in affine space or really projective space. What's important about them is that they have boundaries of all possible dimensions. Okay, so I have this is a whole two-dimensional region here, but it has one-dimensional boundaries, and it has zero-dimensional boundaries. Okay, so positive geometry loosely is some compact region in some space with boundaries of all possible codimension. Okay, so codimension 1, 2, 3, all the way up to points. Okay? All right? All right, so on the one hand, there's a geometry. There's a real geometry. Okay. On the other hand, associated with this real geometry is a certain complex analytic differential form. So that's part of the magic, is that there's something that's just, remember, where we're going eventually is that in kinematic space, in just the space of the on-shell data, okay, we want to find something there. Okay, we want to ask a question in that space, which is going to spit out a scattering amplitude, or something related to a scattering amplitude, or the wave function of the universe. The first thing we're going to do when we get there is we're going to identify natural geometric subregions in that space. Okay, so that's so And they will have this feature. Okay, they'll have this feature that they'll have boundaries of all possible codimension, but it's just some geometry. It'll just be some geometric part of the configuration space. What allows us to attach some, you know, formulas with this region, something we can call a scattering amplitude of the wave function of the universe, is this second idea, a certain complex, a certain differential form. Okay, it's, there's a differential form omega. So if this real geometry is P for positive, there's a differential form associated with P, which is determined, which is unique, determined by the property of having logarithmic singularities. And I'll define what I mean by this, on all the boundaries of P. On all the boundaries of P. And the emphasis on the word on, all. Okay, so let me define the words here. Let me best describe it by first doing the simplest examples. Okay, so the very simplest example is an interval. So imagine I have an interval. Let's call this variable x. Okay, and call the space z, doesn't matter. And so here is z equals b, and this is the region that I'm talking about. Okay, just the inside of that interval. But I also want to have a certain one form. It's a one-dimensional region, so I want to have a one form. I want to have a one form that has properties that has logarithmic singularities here and there. Now, what does logarithmic singularity mean? Logarithmic singularity in this case means just something that locally, logarithmic singularity means that locally the form, there's some coordinates where it looks like dz over z. Okay, so it has a pole and there's a non-zero residue around the pole. Let's say it looked like dz over z squared, then there isn't a well-defined pole associated with that. You could just be using bad coordinates. You could switch from z to 1 over w, and then in the new variables, there's no pole. If you like, there's a double pole, but in any case, there's no residue around it. Okay, so there are things that look like dz over z. We can also rewrite that as d log z, which is why it's called logarithmic singularities. Okay, so that's what it means for a form to have logarithmic singularities. It means that in the neighborhood of every place where it has a singularity, there is a set of coordinates where you can write it as a sum of a wedge product of a bunch of d logs of coordinates. It doesn't have to necessarily just be one such sum. You might have to express it as a sum of a bunch of such terms. But in the neighborhood of every singularity, it's possible to express it so that everything looks like a bunch of d logs. What that means in practice is that if someone hands you a form like that, let's get there. Let's first write the example in this case. So what is the canonical form in this case? Now, remember, the important thing, so I want it to have logarithmic singularities here and there, okay? And so what could I write down? Well, if I just say logarithmic singularities and nothing else, I could write down, well, something that looked like d log z minus a and d log z minus b, okay? And just with the rules so far, I don't know, I could have some coefficient A here and some coefficient B there. Okay? But if A and B are random, there's something wrong with this form. What's wrong with it? Let's say A and B are totally random. If A and B are totally random, then despite the fact that I think I've only put a singularity at A and at B, I also have a logarithmic singularity at infinity. Right? After all, there's three residues here. There's three poles at A, B, and infinity. There's a residue theorem that tells you the sum of all the residues adds up to zero. So if A plus B is not equal to zero, there has to be a third residue at infinity whose residue is negative A plus B, right? So that means that if A is not equal to minus B, this form does not have logarithmic singularities just on this interval. It has logarithmic singularities there, but also has singularities elsewhere. So already here we see that we want the form to be a slave to the geometry, to have singularities on the boundaries and nowhere else, okay? And already here, it's slightly trivial in this case, but already here we see it forces A equals minus B. And then on top of that, we can just by convention say that we want the actual value of the residue to be 1, okay? Whether it's plus or minus one, it doesn't matter. There's an overall orientation to the whole thing, so I'm never going to be precise. Well, I'll eventually be precise, but for now, we don't care about the overall sign, okay? But it has to look like this with a minus sign here, okay? All right, I can rewrite this as d log, so z minus a over z minus b if I want. Okay, so this is a one form with logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of the interval. Is that clear? Okay. Now, it's going to be very useful for us to think about all these things projectively. So let me spend a moment talking about polytopes in general and projective polytopes. Okay, and let me begin with a quick motivation in higher dimensions. We'll go back to that example in a sec. But let's say you want to talk about all the points on the inside of this triangle. I give you a triangle, I give you some coordinates, x1, x2, x3, just in order to be maximally unscared. I'll even put vector signs on top of it because I'm not proud. Okay, so they're really just two-dimensional vectors. And so what are all the points on the inside? All the points on the inside of the triangle, any point in the triangle, can be written as some weighted sum of the vertices. So I can write as w1 x1 plus w2 x2 plus w3 x3. Okay? And I have to normalize so the weights add up to 1. So I can do that by dividing by w1 plus w2 plus w3. And I say that all these weights are positive. Okay? So in this case, as I move around these weights, I just move around inside the triangle. And so the space where all the weights are positive, and you'll notice that because I'm dividing by the sum, the weights are only defined up to overall rescaling. They could be masses, for example, so the units don't matter. In this case, there's a sort of one-to-one mapping. There's as many variables here as there are the dimensionality of the space. And so anyway, that's very simple. But there's an even more elegant way of talking about this, which is if I imagine thinking of these instead of as a two-dimensional vector, I think of it as a three-dimensional vector up to rescaling. Okay, so this is the familiar way of talking about a two-dimensional space a two-dimensional projective space as a set of lines passing through the origin in three dimensions. Okay, so let me draw a different picture now. Let's imagine I have a three-dimensional space and I have a set of all lines passing through the origin. Okay, so I choose some origin. I'm only interested in the set of all lines passing through the origin for the moment. Okay, so I can parametrize all the lines, at least in one coordinate chart. I can parametrize all the lines just by telling you where it intersects a particular plane. Okay, so if you make a choice of some plane, which is conventionally called the plane at infinity, okay, if you make a choice of some plane, now I can specify what all the lines are just by telling you some two-dimensional coordinates on the plane, right? So this is the way we think about a two-dimensional projective space as lines through the origin in three dimensions. So practically speaking, what that means is that I think of some three vector, xi, I runs from 1 to 3, and I'm identifying them with any multiple of itself. Okay, so that's what it means to just talk about the space of lines. And there is a coordinate chart where I can, for example, put xi to be 1. I can use the t to scale the top component to 1, and the bottom coordinates are the little two-dimensional vectors. Okay, so this is perfectly fine. Now, in fact, the deep thing about projective space, or the deep thing about realizing, thinking about a two-dimensional space in this three-dimensional way, going up one in dimension, is it manifests the following fact that purely two-dimensionally looks slightly mysterious. And this is the question in modern language that Desargues and other people asked in the 1500s, and that I recently found out Newton understood 100 years before the rest of the European mathematicians started thinking about it again, 100 years later, If you just ask the following simple question on the plane, just on the plane, what are all transformations on the plane that map straight lines into straight lines? Okay, so that's a very natural question. And you would naively think that the transformations are, well, linear transformations clearly map straight lines into straight lines, 2x2 linear transformations. Translations clearly map straight lines into straight lines. But in fact, there are more transformations that map straight lines into straight lines. Okay, so what I just told you is an SL2, okay, 2x2 linear transformations and translations. But there's a whole SL3's worth of transformations that actually map straight lines into straight lines. And the ones that we're talking about, the ones that are linear transformations and also translations, actually, they have something, they have the following peculiar feature, is that they treat parallel lines as special. These transformations, the SL2 and the translations, map straight lines into straight lines, but they also map parallel lines into parallel lines. Okay? However, the whole idea of Desargues and friends, and they were thinking about learning how to draw in perspective and so on, so they had artistic reasons for thinking about these things too, is that you want to lose this notion of parallelism, because the notion of parallelism makes a distinction between lines. Sometimes two lines intersect at a point, but sometimes if they're parallel, they seem not to intersect. So the whole idea is to add a whole line of points at infinity, which in drawing is the horizon, okay? But the idea is to add a whole line of points at infinity to your two-dimensional space, such that now in this augmented space, everything, all statements are symmetrical. So any two lines intersect at a point. Okay? That point might happen to be on the line at infinity. But with that added, then the set of all, now first of all, there's a very simple model for that, which is exactly this one, right? Now, instead of thinking about a points in two dimensions, you think about lines in a three-dimensional, lines for the origin in three dimensions. And now in this larger picture, it's clear that 3x3 linear transformations on these lines map straight lines into straight lines. Okay? So there's a larger transformation, an SL3's worth of transformation that maps straight lines into straight lines. However, it does not, in general, map parallel lines into parallel lines, okay? So a general SL3 transformation will mess things around and change them, okay? So there's a larger symmetry that lines on the plane have, and that larger symmetry is made manifest by going to this one higher dimensional picture, okay? All right, but so that's the real gain of thinking about just from a purely two-dimensional point of view, if you don't have a notion of distance, so roughly speaking, there are symmetries. There's an SL3, that's 3x3 linear transformations. There's an SL2 cross translations that are a subgroup of that, okay? And that is a subgroup that keeps a particular line invariant, okay? So that's a subgroup that keeps a particular line invariant. And then there are smaller subgroups. For example, there's SO2 cross translations. That has a notion of distance in it. Okay? So you can have a notion of a Euclidean metric, for example. So in doing all these things, we're adding more structure and preserving a smaller subgroup of the original SL3. Anyway, that's a little crash course on two-dimensional and general projective geometry. But from our perspective, we don't need all this. We're not going to really use a lot of that information. Just know that it's very useful to think about two-dimensional geometry like this as really living in one higher dimension in this way. And for example, this formula for all the points on the inside now looks slightly simpler. Okay. Now I don't have to divide by W1 plus W2 plus W3 anymore. Okay? Because projectively, that's exactly what's happening. See, if I just expand this out, this would be W1 plus W2 plus W3, and then W1 X1 plus W2 X2 plus W3 X3, which is the same, if I go back to 1, as 1 W1 X1 plus W3X3 over W1 plus W2 plus W3. Okay? And in this language, there's always, everything you do, there's a GL3 transformation or GLN plus one transformation that always acts on this, on that index. Okay, so now, so if I go back and then describe, if I go back and describe even this one dimensional thing in this, And let me just say, let me say more geometrically what this means. So if I imagine drawing some three-dimensional, each one of the x's is now some three-dimensional vector. Now there is some arrow here, right? There's some three-dimensional vector. This is the vector x1, x2, x3. It's now a three-dimensional picture. Then what are all these y's? All these y's are, because I'm allowed to take any weights in these directions, then it's just this whole cone. Right? It's a whole cone in these directions. Not a triangle, it's just a whole cone in those directions. However, what's the triangle? It, remember, to go to the two-dimensional picture, I have to intersect with some plane here. Okay? So the triangle we're talking about is just intersecting this with that line. Right? So that's what you can think of as a projective polytope. You can also think of it as a cone over the previous, over the, so if you have any picture, you have any picture of a polygon or a polytope or anything you want in some dimensional space, you can lift it to one higher dimension as a cone, okay? As a cone in all those directions. And that's the more convenient thing that we're always going to be thinking about. The converse is not necessarily true, by the way, okay? It's not necessarily true if I give you a random collection of x's. Let's say I give you a random, now more than three. If I give you a random collection xn, okay? Let's actually do it in one direction. If I say y is w1x1 plus dot dot wnxn, okay? Then if I write all of the x's as 1x, then clearly this is giving me the inside of some polygon, for example, or, you know, something whose vertices are all the x's, right? So this is the weighted sum of everything on the inside of the polygon. Okay, but this is possible. It's possible to put all the x's in the form 1x and not minus 1x with a plus 1 up there if the underlying three-dimensional vectors are all on the same side of some hyperplane. So this is good, right? Because they're all on the same side of some hyperplane. This is bad. Even imagine this is a two-dimensional picture. This is bad, right? Because here, here, if I look at the positive linear combination of all these x's, I just get the entire plane. Okay. So for this formula. So for this to define a nice geometric space, it had better be that that all of these x's lie on the same side of some hyperplane. Now, in fact, there's a very, very simple and pretty characterization of when that happens. The expression is telling you immediately when you should worry about it. This whole picture is supposed to make sense projectively, but the origin is not part of the projective space. 0, 0, 0 is not part of the projective space, right? Therefore, you have to make sure that the x's are such that this formula on the right-hand side never can equal 0. 0, 0, 0, the vector 0, 0, 0, right? And, well, if you choose completely random x's, that's for sure not true. Totally random x's, there's be some combination of them which adds up to 0. But precisely if they're all on the same side of some hyperplane, then that's not possible, okay? So to summarize, you take any picture of an interval, polygon, polytope, any such picture in a fixed number of dimensions lifts to a projective cone, and we can think of it as a projective polytope, okay? And the converse is not necessarily true, okay? For the converse to be true, the guys who's, sometimes this is called taking the convex hull, the guys whose convex hull you're taking all have to be on the same side of some hyperplane. Okay, but that was just a quick introduction to motivate why working in working projectively is useful. In projective space, there's no metric, there's nothing other than the only invariant symbol we have is the epsilon symbol and nothing else. Our symmetries, the only symmetry transformations are GLN or GLN plus one. So the only invariant tensor is the epsilon symbol. So that means, for instance, let's say again, I'm talking this is just a little bit of projective practice, okay? Let's say I have 2 points. This should convince you that it's fun to work in projective space. Let's say I have 2 points, x1 and x2. And so again, this is a three-dimensional vector, this is some three-dimensional vector, okay? Now, okay, so far so good. Now, how do I think of a line in projective space? How do I think of a straight line? A straight line is just some linear equation, right? So again, if you're a normal person, you would write down a linear equation like ax plus by plus z equals 0, okay? Ax plus by plus c equals 0, sorry. I guess it doesn't matter, but all right. And so, okay, that's fine. But this equation is more nicely written as ax plus by plus cz equals 0, where we now say that xyz, let me put zxy, is identified with any multiple times zxy. Right? Now this equation is nice and homogeneous, and of course, I can always use the rescaling to set z to 1 and come back to the previous equation. All right? So that immediately tells us what a line looks like in this two-dimensional projective space. If I have points that are xi with an upstairs index, then the equation that defines a line is some l lower I x upper I equals 0. Okay? So x upper I are points, l lower I are lines. Is that clear? You give me, and the upper and the lower just indicate how they transform under GL3. Okay, so they just transform with upstairs and downstairs indices under GL3. Now we can immediately see, and you know, if nothing else you'll get out of this lecture, you'll never have to do stupid things again when you're trying to do simple linear algebra and plot lines and planes and stuff like that. Let's say I have 2 points, x1 and x2. There's a line that passes through them. What is that line? So here's x1 and x2. Okay. So there's a line that passes through them. What's the formula for the line? What do you think the formula for the line is? You have to come up with some L. You have to come up with some L such that L lower I, x1 I is 0, and also x2 I is 0, right? There's something that satisfies both of those things. But the beauty of working in this way is that you don't have to think, okay? You just take the things that you're given and you just make any expression that has the indices in the right place. And then you always get the right answer, okay? So you somehow have to take out of x1 and x2, you have to make something with a downstairs index. What is the only invariant tensor we have in this problem? Epsilon ijk. So what is it? Well, the only thing I can do is take two of these guys and lower the index with an epsilon symbol. So that's the answer. L is epsilon ijk, x1j, x2k. Isn't that cool? Okay. And how can you check? Well, let me check that L dot x1 is 0. Indeed, it's 0 because I'm contracting two x1s together antisymmetrically. And L dot x2 is also 0. Very nice. All right? Now, this example is a little bit trivial. What about the other way, right? What if you have two lines? What point do they define? Okay, if I give you L1 and L2, they intersect at a point. Okay? What is the point? Well, you could write down ax plus by plus c equals 0, cx plus dy plus e equals 0, two equations and two unknowns. You could do that, or you could just write down L1i, L2j, epsilon ijk, and call it a day, okay? That's the point where they intersect. Right? Now, with lines, and if you go to higher dimensions, something with one downside, let's say I go to a three-dimensional space. So I'm now thinking about points and lines and planes in three dimensions. I have a three-dimensional space, then a hyperplane, a two-dimensional hyperplane, is something with a downstairs index, one downstairs index. Okay? What is a line? What is a line in three dimensions? A line in three dimensions now. Line in three dimensions, I can define by giving two points, right? Give two points. So both of those points have got to be on the line. So the only thing it can be is a two-index antisymmetric tensor. Well, that looks like x1i, x2j, minus the other way around. Okay, so lines are two-index antisymmetric tensors. And so points are, So I can say that a point xi is a point, some lij, antisymmetric and ij is a line, and here is some hyperplane ijk, which could be fully antisymmetrized as a plane. And of course, vice versa, I can lower all the indices. So this, using the now the four-dimensional epsilon tensor. So this could be some epsilon jkl, some lkl, all antisymmetrized, and some hi. Okay? Okay, so that's what points, lines, planes in general. K-planes of general dimensionality are just k-index antisymmetric are just represented by k-index antisymmetric tensors. So, if you want to do trickier things, like I have two hyperplanes in three dimensions, they intersect on a line. Which line do they intersect on? Well, just that one, right? Hi, hj, the antisymmetric thing, that tells me the line. Okay. A line intersects a plane and a point. Which point? It's all the same, right? Just the hyperplane got into the line with two upstairs indices, and it tells me the point. Okay, and you can do this all day long. Let me, this is just linear algebra, but of course, it's linear algebra sort of, done, I think, as transparently as it can be. Let me just, this is just for fun, just so you play a little bit before we, get to more meaty matters. Let's go back to the plane. Let me tell you how to think about conics. Just to show you that there's some real beef here. Oh, before doing that, let me say a few other things. So because the only, about lines and points and planes and stuff, because the only invariant tensor we have is the epsilon symbol, again, there's no notion of distance. So it doesn't mean anything to say these two points are close or far. We don't have any metric in this space. Okay, and again, by doing an SL3 transformation, I can bring them arbitrarily close or arbitrarily far. So there's no notion of distance. The only notions that make sense are notions of incidence. Okay, so what does make sense is if three points are on a straight line or not. Okay, and so every interesting statement can be cast ultimately in terms of invariance where you contract everything with the epsilon symbol. That's the only invariant tensor we have. So throughout the whole rest of this discussion, whenever I put some objects in a bracket like this, doesn't matter how many objects I have in the middle, it'll never be ambiguous. I mean, you contract all the indices of all the objects that are involved just with the epsilon symbol and nothing else, because that's all we have, okay? So three points are collinear, one, two, three. Three points are collinear means that this bracket is equal to zero. So that's when interesting things can happen, okay, is when some of these brackets or more complicated combinations of brackets are actually equal to zero. But apart from that, there's no notion of distance. So far, as I said, everything is trivial. Everything is linear algebra. But I'll give you two little exercises. Then, as I say, we'll get on to something more interesting. We'll get back to our main topic. But I'm going through all this because... I think one of the main obstacles, completely trivial obstacles to people thinking about the kind of questions that I was mentioning is that some of this absolutely trivial stuff about projective geometry is not taught in high schools anymore. It used to be taught in high school, even in junior high school. It's not taught anymore. We do calculus and fancier things. But these are much simpler, but they're not standard to everyone. If you're going to work in the subject, you have to live in projective space. You have to be happy and comfortable there. Okay, so I'm trying to at least give you a flavor of what it takes to be happy and comfortable there. But let me just give you two little challenges. One of them is what not me, but Hilbert called the first non-trivial theorem in algebra, in geometry. If you haven't read it, Hilbert has a wonderful book called Geometry and the Imagination or something like that. It's a lay book, but for some kind of pretty badass lay people, I guess. But in this book, Hilbert calls this the first non-trivial theorem in geometry. Actually, it's a small generalization of it. But it was observed by some Greek guy called Pappus 2,000 years ago by walking around olive groves and looking at shadows cast by them at various times of day. The following interesting fact. If you have 3 points on a line and another 3 points on a different line, then if you make the following lines, so 1B, 2A, that gives you a new point. They intersect. 2C, 3B, that gives you another point. And if I did this right, which I'm sure I did not, 3C, that one, that gives you a point. And what Pappus observed is that all three of these points are actually collinear. The challenge for you is to prove this. Okay? And you can, of course, the Greeks had a proof, and there's a pictorial proof. But prove it using these methods, right? Just represent these points. Just represent them with, I've x1, x2. The fact that three, for example, you could just do most moronically, just put x1, x2, x3 is some linear combination of 1 and 2. Okay? And then you put xa, xb, xc is some linear combination of a and b. And then just compute all these points by just doing all those epsilons. Put them all together, shove them all in some gigantic epsilon, and observe to your delight that all the terms cancel, tick, 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 and you get zero. Okay, and it's a three-line proof of this fact, right? So that's the kind of thing that this algebraic approach to a projective geometry started making manifest. In fact, there's a more general statement that's exactly the same statement is true. If instead of these 3 points individually being on two lines, you just had 6 points on a conic. If you just take 6 points on a conic, exactly the same thing is true, and that's called Pascal's theorem. Yeah, that's Pascal proved it when he was 15 years old. And that's what Hilbert actually called the first non-trivial theorem in algebra. And that one you can also prove in exactly the same way. Okay, so... Okay, and in fact, that'll give me a little excuse to say a few things about conics, and this is the last bit of recreation. But again, this is all meant to encourage you to play in projective space and get to know it. So what is a conic? A conic, again, in the dumb way of doing things is ax squared plus bxy plus cy squared, I'm getting tired, dx plus ey plus f equals zero. Okay? So that's a general conic on the plane. And what is it projectively? I go back and I put z's everywhere. dxz, eyz, fz squared is equal to zero. Okay? Now this is exactly the same as before. And if I can rescale z to one, and I'm back to the picture we had before. But that means that a conic is some c lower ij, xi, xj equals zero, right? So a conic is a two-index symmetric tensor, okay? Lines is a two-index anti-symmetric tensor. A conic is a two-index symmetric tensor, okay? And now let's have some similar fun with conics. So, let's say I give you a conic. There's a conic. And I pick a point on the conic. There's a line which is tangent to the conic at the point. Okay. Now, Maybe up to this point, you're like, oh, big deal, you know, just a bunch of stupid linear algebra. This is also a bunch of stupid linear algebra, but I would at least start getting scared, right? You know, oh my God, I have to take a derivative. How do I figure out what the, and now it really starts seeming like work, right? Okay, so I give you a point x star on the conic. Okay, here's the conic, Cij. So what is the line that's tangent to the conic at that point? What do you think it is? I think you had it, but why don't you just say it? You just contract it. That's right. You can just do it. Just do it. You'll be happy. Everything will be fine.
This is the line with the Downsizer's index.
That's a line that's tangent to the conic. By the way, let's check that the point is on the line. The point is on the line because if I multiply this by x star, remember, cx squared equals 0 on the conic. So it's cx star x star equals 0. Great. Okay. How about this? Let's say I have a point that's not on the conic. So here's some random point out there, not on the conic. Now, I can do the following. I can draw this tangent. I can draw that tangent. Each one defines a point. And now I can look at this line. Okay, so now this is really a lot of crap, right? So who is that line? Who is this line? There's a conic C, XI, CIJ. There's a line, the only line that I can make out of this data. I drop these tangents, I make this line, I get this line. Who is that line? It's exactly the same. Just remove the star. Okay? Now, slightly more actually. Let me take this equation and look at C. Let's say there's an X and a Y such that CXY equals 0. Right? So let's say I have a pair X and Y such that CXY equals 0. So what does that mean? That means that Y is on this line. Y is somewhere on this line. Right? I mean, Y is on the line that's made out of X. But notice this is a symmetrical statement between x and y. So that immediately tells me something. That tells me that x is on the same line that I make with y, which it is. Okay? Now that's another little theorem in Euclid. Okay, but there's no thinking, right? You just indices, bloop, 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 and it's all trivial, right? So that's the sort of thing that you buy. When I told you that geometry is easy when you think projectively, so long as there's no distances involved, this is what I mean. And you can do many more exercises like this, and I encourage you to just play with lines and conics and crap like that. Okay? And these are really simple examples. There are much more interesting things that you can do. But the key word is no notion of distance. So no metric. There's no metric. Anything in plane geometry without a metric, you should do projectively, and you'll be happy about it. I'll make a final comment before getting back to business. There's a fact that the early projective geometers discovered, and they're very impressed by, and it's the earliest notion of duality that people ever talked about. And people noticed the following remarkable thing about projective geometry in a plane. That if you take any statement that was true about points and lines in a plane, any statement that's true about points and lines in a plane, if you reverse the words, if you interchange the word point and line, you'd get another true statement. Okay? Not at all obvious, but we can start with the first few, right? Any two points define a line. True. Okay? Well, any two lines define a point. Also true. Once we add infinity back so that there's no parallel lines, any two lines define a point. Okay? You can keep going up in simple examples like that. But when we get to this business with conics and stuff like that, it starts being much less trivial to me. For example, if you take that, a little exercise for you to take that Pappus configuration and just draw the dual of it. So what would the dual of this Pappus thing be? The dual would be take three lines that pass through a common point. That's the dual of three points on a line. Take another three lines that pass through a point. And now you have to build, I'll let you do the rest of it. Okay, you have to build some set of things that intersect, blah, blah, blah. And you have to build three new lines that all pass through another common third point. Okay? That's a true statement. You can verify, draw in pictures, but on the face of it, it's not at all obvious that that one statement should imply the other one, just geometrically, right? And that's what people discovered. Desargues and his friends discovered this already in the 1500s, is that there's this projective duality between interchanging points and lines. And in higher dimensions, it's between intersecting k-dimensional objects and n minus k-dimensional objects, okay, in general. Now, what is that duality from this algebraic point of view? It's just moving indices upstairs and downstairs. Okay? There's no meaning to whether the indices were upstairs or downstairs. And you can decide that a point is something with an upstairs index and a line is something with a downstairs index, or vice versa. Okay? So that utterly trivial equivalence between GL and GL inverse, if you like, is the algebraic understanding of this point-plane duality. It's the earliest known example of a duality in any part of science, and it's still rather striking. Okay, all right, so now we're all experts in projective space. Let's go back to our problem of thinking about geometries and canonical forms.
Quick question.
Yes.
In your approach, you were saying if your line is antisymmetric, plane, etc. So it seems like you have a notion of orientation.
Yes.
Whereas when I just solve an equation for a line, I have no idea what the orientation of it is. So how are the two completely identical?
Well, because any statement you make is any interesting statement you make should be invariant under rescaling. Okay. So if you say three guys are let's say 1, 2, 3 equals 0. That's a statement that's invariant under rescaling 1, 2, and 3 by anything, whether it's positive or negative. Okay, and so that's the answer to that question. More generally, when you get into more interesting situations, you have to build out of these determinants. You have to build objects that are invariant under rescaling of every coordinate, every xi independently. Okay, so those things are in general called cross ratios. And again, all those things are, in fact, by construction, only a function of the line and not of the orientation on the line. Okay? Does that answer your question? Yeah, and in fact, you know, so all such cross ratios depend in the end on an even number of things, because they're the ratio of some number of things upstairs and some number of things downstairs, so they only ever have an even number of epsilon symbols. And so either you can have things with odd number of epsilon symbols vanishing, or you have things that involve ratios of an even number of epsilon symbols. But by construction, they're only a function of things that depend on the lines. All right, so let's go back to this problem, and now let's say it projectively. So here I had this variable, I had A and B, and now I'm going to think of this A as instead being some point, let me call it capital A, which is like 1A, and capital B, which is 1B, and I had my variable, I called it Z before, let me call it capital Z, which again could be projectivized to one little z, okay? Now, what is something like dz over z minus a? That's dz over z minus little a. So we had a form in the end that was like that was dz over dz b minus a over z minus a z minus b. That was our one form. And let me say this in this projective language. So in this projective language, it's z dz a b over z a z b. So let's stare at this for a second. All right, let's stare at this for the moment. First of all, what is this weird looking z dz? That's a kind of a strange looking thing. Normally you think of it as a measure as just d something. What is this z dz? Well, I can't take the dz of some component. I'm in Canada, so I'm saying z again. I'm very happy. Okay, so normally you can't take you can't just take one component, right? So the only invariant symbol I have is the epsilon symbol, right? And so I need a one form, so I'm going to contract it with z. It's a Z D Z. You might, your heart is screaming at this because like, oh my God, this is vanishing when Z is zero. There's an origin. It's not translationally invariant. Remember, there's no metric. There's no origin. Nothing. The only symmetry is SL2 in this case, right? So this is perfectly healthy, perfectly nice. It's more than healthy and nice, in fact. It's crucial. In fact, any form on a projective space, on a P1 in this case, any one form on P1 must be of the form Z dz times some function that has weight minus 2 in Z. Okay? What I mean by weight minus 2 is that F minus H for any H is defined such that you just pick up a factor of FH is T to the H F of Z. So that's just some homogeneity under rescaling. Okay, so that much is pretty obvious, right? You want this whole thing. I want to have the symmetry under Z to identify Z and any T times Z. So it's clear the whole thing should have no weight. So this has weight 2, so this thing should have weight minus 2, right? But why couldn't I have had A dz times something of weight minus 1? That also looks fine, okay? It's just something, it's some form, but I'm saying that's not possible. And the reason is that you want the form to be, in order for the form to be well-defined on the projective space, it is not invariant for, it's not enough for it to be invariant under a global rescaling that Z goes to TZ, where T is independent of Z. The problem is that, there's a Z here and there's another Z here. Each one of them is associated with its own ray. There's no correlation whatsoever between the T here and the T there. I should be able to choose, make any choice I want for what I mean by the Z's, even at nearby points. So that means that my form needs to have an invariance. My form, for the form to be projective, I must have invariance under Z goes to T of Z. Z, a local GL1. Local GL1, not just the global one. Okay? And you see, this is badly not true for that one, right? Because if I dz goes to t dz plus z dt, okay? So if I do this, it does that, right? So this thing is not invariant because of that piece. However, this one is, and that's why there has to be a z in front in order to kill the piece by anti-symmetric contraction that has the dt in it. Okay, so this is a very important point. Any form on a projective space has to look like Z, DZ, 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 however many things you have, but there has to be a Z in front of the whole thing. And that's the overall, that's the measure that has to be there for any form on any projective space. So, all right, so that explains this first part. Now, in order to get a little more comfortable with it, let's just evaluate it in these coordinates. Okay, so what is Z, DZ? Well, this is just the anti-symmetric contraction of 1Z contracted with dz, which is 0 dz. So I have to contract these with the epsilon symbol, right? So that's just a little determinant, which is dz minus 0. So this is just dz. Good. All right? Okay, now what about the rest? See, what's nice about this is that it just tells you where the poles are obvious. Is when z is on top of A, when Z is on top of B. And this thing upstairs is just to ensure that this has vanishing weight under rescaling A and rescaling B independently. Okay, so you have to have something that's projectively well-defined for everybody. So we just said for projective well-definedness on Z, it has to have this local GL1 invariance. And then it also has to separately be invariant under rescaling A, under rescaling B. Okay, is that clear? So this is the form with this is the form, so this is it in particular coordinates. This is a coordinate independent way. Here's another way of writing it. We can write it in a way that makes the D log more manifest as D log ZA over ZB. Okay? And you'll notice in this form, the invariance under the rescaling, even of T of Z on Z, is also manifest. All right? So these are various ways of writing this one form with logarithmic singularities on this interval. Any questions? So we're done with our first canonical form and our first positive geometry. So we have a little interval, and this is its canonical form. All right. Let's move on to the next example. Now that we're experts, we can do it more quickly. The next example is the inside of a triangle. Okay, so let's say that I have a triangle, and so there's a point Y, or I guess I was calling it Z, so now this is some ZI, and then there are some lines. Let me call the lines L1, L2, and L3. Okay? Okay? Now, I want to write a form which has logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of the triangle. So what does that mean? That means that I want to have a form which has simple poles when Z hits this line, when Z hits that line, when Z hits that line. And we'll see, we need more than that, because when I take a residue to like, for Z to actually be on that line now, I can take a residue. It's going to be a two form because it's a two-dimensional picture, right? When I take a residue, I'm going to have the one form, and on that line, the one form needs to have singularities only at these, at the vertices. Okay, so that's the point. It has logarithmic singularities on and only on the boundaries of the geometry. So in the case of a triangle, it's still pretty trivial, and we can guess the answer very easily. What is it? Okay, well, it has to have a Z, DZ, DZ. Now it's a two form. Okay? Notice, normally, two things wedged together would give me zero. But these are differential forms. They're anti-commuting. So when dx wedged dy minus dy wedged dx is dx wedged dy with a factor of two. And I'm not going to keep track of factors of two. Okay. Okay. So this makes perfect sense. And what do I have? Downstairs, I should have zi l1i. So z dot l1, I won't keep writing the indices, is z dot l2. Z dot L3. And what should I have upstairs? Well, I just have to contract L1, L2, and L3 in order for things to have the correct weights. Okay? That's it. So that's a two form. That's the only two form that you could write down, and it has logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of the on the boundaries. Now, let's see if this makes sense. I can, for example, let me write this another way. What if instead of giving you the data of the lines, I gave you the vertices? Well, let's say I give you some vertices, x1, x2, and x3. All right? Instead of the lines. Then the form is equally simple. It's still z, dz, dz. And now there would be an x1, x2, x3 squared upstairs divided by z, x1, x2, z, x2, x3, z, x3, x1. Okay? So you see, there's a singularity when z is on the line x1, x2. That's that form, x2, x3, x3, x1. Now, every X appears downstairs twice, so for the weights to come out right, I have to have this thing squared upstairs. Okay. And you would, of course, get exactly this formula if you wrote each one of the L's as XX, right? Which is what they are, and just shoved it back in here. So that's how you get the square up there. Okay. Right? So that's a canonical form with logarithmic singularities on a triangle. Okay, we can write it many other ways. For instance, let's say I expanded, z is a two-dimensional vector, so I could expand z is equal to, let's say, x1 plus beta x2 plus gamma x3. I can always do that, right? I mean, z is a three-dimensional vector, so I could always expand it even with an alpha here, but I can always projectivize by rescaling. I can always set alpha to 1 if I want to. Okay, so I've, in this way, I've manifestly parameterized it with 2 variables, which is the dimensionality of the space. Okay, so let's just see what happens. So what is z dz dz? Z dz dz, z dz dz is just equal to x1, x2, x3, d beta, d gamma. Is that clear? Is that clear why that's the case? Okay, so in the dz, the x1 disappears. Okay, so dz dz is d beta d gamma times x2. And then when I contract with the z, I just have to pick up the x1. Anyway, there's nothing else it could be. So, all right, that's z dz dz. So meanwhile, what is z x1 x2? Z x1 x2, well, I have to contract this with x1 and x2, so that just is gamma. So this is gamma times x1 x2 x3. Z x2 x3 is just x1 x2 x3. And finally, z x3 x1 is beta x1 x2 x3. I'm not being careful about the signs. Okay, but then that means the whole form is just equal to x1, x2, x3 upstairs cubed d alpha, d beta, d gamma. And downstairs I have beta gamma and then an x1, x2, x3 all cubed. Dutifully these things drop out and I just get d log beta d log gamma, right? So that's great. It's a form of logarithmic singularity. It's exactly where you'd expect it, right? It's when beta goes to 0 and infinity, when gamma goes to 0 and infinity. And beta goes to 0 and infinity, gamma goes to 0 and infinity are exactly hitting the various boundaries of this triangle. Okay? So this means that we can also write this form, for example, as d log zx1, x2 over zx1, x3, d log x2, x3, d log z x1, x3 over z x2, x3. Okay, so it's 2 d logs, d log, d log. And notice it looks like you're breaking the symmetry between them by putting somebody downstairs, but in fact the object is cyclically invariant. Okay, it's totally invariant. Just a particular coordinate, particular presentation. So, we've seen now the one-dimensional example, just the interval, and the two-dimensional example. We've seen it in many ways. You can choose coordinates. In particular coordinates, it just looks like d log d log. We can write it very beautifully invariantly. And we can also, in a coordinate-independent way, we can also write it as d log in a coordinate-independent way. Almost every time you write it as d log explicitly, you're always making a choice. Okay? It's not possible to present the d log form in a way that's completely manifestly symmetric ever. And that's because any such presentation of the form is making some of the singularities manifest, putting them at the origin, and some of them are being sent to infinity. Okay? So the whole coordinate independent presentation of the whole object, of course, has the correct singularities everywhere. Any given presentation in terms of d logs is only going to make some of the singularities manifest. All right, so far we're doing totally simple things, and now let me give you the first non-trivial example of a positive geometry and its associated canonical form. I think after you see this example, you'll see what the... Then we can switch back to a physics. All right, so let's do a quadrilateral. Every time I draw a quadrilateral, I draw them with parallel lines, which makes it impossible. So there we go. Okay, so here's a quadrilateral whose corners are 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay? Now there's a positive geometry. Well, there's clearly, there's the interior. And now I want to write down a two form, which has the property that has logarithmic singularities on all the boundaries just of that little square. Okay? So how do I do it? Well, let's start trying to do it. We're experts now. So there's some z, dz, dz. And downstairs, I have to have, well, clearly I have to have a pole when z hits a line 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 4, 1. So I have to put a z, 1, 2, z, 2, 3, z, 3, 4, z, 4, 1. Okay? But now already there's something interesting. Because remember, the whole form has to have vanishing weight under rescaling z, but it has four z's downstairs and only three upstairs. So that means upstairs there has to be a numerator with one power of z in it. Okay, so there's some magic line up here. There's some line that we need, li, zi. And at the moment, we don't know who the line is. Okay? Okay, any questions about this so far? Is it clear why I put all these things down here, right? I want to have a pole when z is on the line 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 4, 1. But you see, it is not enough to say that I have a pole there. Because let's say I look at the pole when I sit on the line 1, 2, right? So I take the residue there. In this case, literally, these are all just linear in all the variables. I can literally just take a residue in one variable. Now I'm on the line 1, 2. I have a new function. Now I have just one variable left that parameterizes where I am on the line. But that new function could, in principle, itself have poles when 2, 3 is 0, 3, 4 is 0, and 4, 1 is 0. Okay? So what are all those points in the geometry? Here I am on the line 1, 2. And so this is the point where 2, 3 could have a pole. Right? This is a point where 4, 1 could have a pole. But there's also this point where 3, 4 could have a pole over here. So let me go through this again. We sit on the line 1, 2. There's a pole on 1, 2. It's a 2, 4. There's a pole on 1, 2. So I take a residue in one variable. So that I now have a 1 form, right? So now the pole 1, 2 is gone. I have a new function. I have a new 1 form, and it has poles in three places, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 4, 1, right? But that means that it has a pole when z is on the line 2, 3. It's already on the line 1, 2. So for it to be both on the line 1, 2 and on the line 2, 3, then the pole is at the location 2. Okay. Similarly, 4, 1, I'm already on the line 1, 2. To also be on the line 1, 4, I have to be there. But there's a third place I could have one where 3, 4 goes to 0. I can be on the line 3, 4 and on the line 1, 2. That's a third place in principle I could have a pole. Okay? That's bad. I don't want to have a pole there. You see, I want this to be a form of logarithmic singularities just on the square, nowhere else. This is the analog of how if we made a random choice for the one form, we also had a pole at infinity. Okay? So now, if I make a random choice here, I have poles elsewhere, not just on the vertices of the geometry. Okay? So this numerator has one job to do. It has to kill. It has to put a zero there. So there's actually no residue there. Now, there's another bad point. Where is the other bad point? Here. Right? So there are two bad points where the form cannot have a residue. All right? So I have to have a line that puts a zero on these two points. So I wonder who that line is. Ta-da! Right? Okay? So now I hope you see what's non-trivial about associating canonical forms with positive geometries. The non-trivial thing is not just a codimension one, but the real intricacy of all the lower boundaries being determined and having logarithmic singularities only on the facets of all codimension of the geometry and nowhere else. Okay? Now, this is a case where we could do it by brute force in this way. right? And in fact, for all polygons, you can do it with the brute force. In a moment, I'll tell you something about canonical forms in the case of polygons and polytopes more generally, which is rather remarkable, that these canonical forms are actually very closely related to the volumes of other polytopes that are dual to these ones. So these interesting formulas that we're writing down are actually new formulas that had never been written down, as far as we know, for things as simple as areas of polygons. Okay, so even ancient things like that have problems like that have some novelty associated with them still. But let me actually tell you what this looks like, how you do this for a pentagon. Let's do the case of the pentagon. So in order to do the pentagon, let me draw it like this. Right? Now, here is my pentagon. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I want to have the canonical form associated with that region. Okay? And I've drawn it like the inside of a star like this, because here are the 5 bad points. There are bad points now. Right? These are the points where I could have a residue, just like before, where I don't want one. All right? So now let's write down what the canonical form is. It's again z dz dz over, then there's a z1, 2, blah, 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 z5, 1. So now there's 5 z's downstairs, only 3 upstairs, so I have to have something quadratic in the z's upstairs. So I have to have a cij zi ZJ upstairs. Okay? So there's a conic sitting around in the problem, right? And there are 5 bad points. Well, guess what? There's a unique conic that passes through 5 points. Okay, and that's what the conic is. All right, so these are cases where you can solve the geometry problems associated with the determining this form rather explicitly. We don't know how to do this, even for polytopes. Doing this in this way, very explicit way, involves solving harder and harder geometry problems. So we've done it in many cases, but even for general polytopes in 3 dimensions, let's say, where we can even classify all polytopes, I don't think it has not been, these geometry problems have not been solved in this explicit way. They have for many classes of polytopes, but not all of them. Okay. But I just wanted you to see what the invariant nature of the problem was. So is it clear now? I hope it's clear from these examples what's non-trivial about these canonical forms. So, and now you see, so there, what the, with a little more, we can say with a little more feeling now, there's a geometry. The real geometry, and a slave to this geometry is a certain differential form. Once you have the form, you can evaluate the form wherever the hell you want. It's not real. You know, you could analytically continue to do anything you want with it. But somehow that differential form is a slave to this real geometry. Okay? And, okay. But more generally, we can't, for even, as I said, even for general polytopes, we don't know how to solve these geometry problems in generality and find these numerators that put zeros in places and so on. Even though it might be an interesting thing to try and tackle directly. But let me tell you just a few facts about canonical forms. And so one of them I can illustrate already if we go back to this example. Okay? So here's a different way of finding a canonical form associated with a square. You can triangulate the square. Right? So this is slightly deceptive. It's not quite as trivial as it seems for a reason that I'll explain in a second. It's pretty trivial, but it's not quite as trivial as it seems. So what I'm saying is, let's say you take 1, 2, 3, 4, and you geometrically triangulate it. Okay? So you really say this triangle plus that triangle. Okay? Triangulation means that the pieces don't overlap except perhaps on boundaries. Okay? Then the claim is that the canonical form for the quadrilateral is just the sum of the canonical forms for the pieces. So in this case, plus omega 1, 3, 4. Okay. Now, why is this not crazy? It's because this omega 1, 2, 3 puts logarithmic singularities in this triangle. Omega 3, 4 puts logarithmic singularities in that triangle. So this is correctly going to have singularities here. All these are fine. The problem is that there's a spurious singularity in the middle. However, we can ask, is there really a residue there on this intermediate line? And well, on this side, the residue there is what I get by jumping there, right? Remember, what I get from jumping there is just supposed to be the canonical form on 1, 3. So it loses all memory of 2 and everything else. By the time I take the residue to jump there from the left, from the omega on the left, it only depends on 1 and 3 on that line. Well, similarly from the right. So despite the fact that these two functions are, of course, different, their residue on 1, 3 is identical. Okay? And then the only thing that you need to hope for is that the sign works out right, but of course the sign works out right. Okay? So the sign works out right, so they actually cancel between one side and the other. Okay? So that means that there is no residue here, and all the other residues are constructed to be correct. Okay? So that's one nice thing. If you have a complicated positive geometry, if you can triangulate it into simpler pieces, then the canonical form for the whole positive geometry is a sum of the canonical forms for the pieces. Okay? That's not quite as trivial as it seems if I give you a more complicated example. Let's say you take this example. You're tempted to say there's some sort of cancellation between these two pieces on that boundary there, for example. Okay? But it's more interesting than that, because the form here certainly has a singularity out here somewhere. It has a singular way the hell out there, too. It has a pole everywhere along this line. Okay? So the argument that the sum of all these pieces cancel is slightly more interesting, but it precisely has to do with the fact that that recursively the residues of the boundaries of positive geometries are positive geometries, and the residues of the canonical form on the boundaries are the canonical forms on the lower boundary. And therefore, the geometric triangulation, not only of the whole space, but of the boundary itself, guarantees that all the residues cancel when you sum everything. Okay? So that's maybe the most interesting, that's the most important fact about canonical geometries, about canonical forms that I'll mention now. They can be computed by triangulation. If you know the answer for simpler pieces. A second fact. Now, everything that I've told you so far is just about polygons and polytopes. I haven't told you about any fancier geometries yet. So part of the interest in even using this fancy word is that we can generalize the notion of polytopes and these positive regions away from Euclidean space, affine space, projective space, into generalizations. So we can generalize them into Grassmannians, we can generalize them into other interesting spaces, where they're not associated with being cut out with flat equations and linear equations in the way we had talked about. They're more curvy in general. So the second thing I'm about to tell you, we do not know the analog of this for general positive geometries yet. We have little bits and pieces of evidence for it, bits and pieces of understanding for it in more general settings than just polygons and polytopes, but we don't know what the general story is. However, there's a beautiful general story for polygons and polytopes, which is the following. So that's fact one. Fact two, for polytopes, is the following. So let's say you have the canonical form for some positive geometry, and it's in this Z space. Okay, so this is Z dnz in general times some function of weight minus n, depends on the polytope, all the vertices and everything, and Z minus n plus 1. Okay? Fact two is that this object has a very beautiful interpretation. This object is actually the volume, really the actual volume of the dual of the polytope They're dual in the sense that you interchange points and planes. Okay, so just the duality we talked about before, a dual of the polytope, where Z is taken as the plane at infinity. And let me define what I mean by that. I'll define what I mean by that in just a moment. Okay. So there's a relationship between the canonical form. You see, what I just told you makes it look like the canonical form is kind of like a volume, right? If I take a big space, I chop it up into little pieces, the canonical form adds. So you're attempting to think of it as a volume, okay? In fact, it's almost a volume, but it's not a volume of the polytope. It's a volume of the dual of the polytope. And let me illustrate this already in the case that we've seen, and then you'll see why it's true in general, quickly. So, let's go back to a formula that many of you have probably seen in high school, high school area of triangle. Okay, how many people remember, probably if you're European, you learned this in grade 6 or whatever, right? You know, so in America, we wait till you're in grad school. So let's say you're given 3 points on the plane, x1, x2, x3. And you want to know the area of the triangle. Okay, well, the area of the triangle is x2 minus x1 cross x3 minus x1, right? It's just that cross product. And that cross product you can think of as the determinant of this matrix. Okay? Have you seen this formula? Okay, good. In grade 6? Yeah, in grade 6. That's what I thought, European, yeah. That's right, I knew it. Sorry to insult you, but all right. So, okay, now. So this looks suspiciously like a projective formula, right? There's this nice one up there. We make these three-dimensional vectors. Of course, it is a projective formula. So what is it? It is this formula is nothing other than x1, x2, x3. Okay? But it has to have vanishing weight in x. So how do I make it have vanishing weight in x? Well, I don't know how to do it other than to define some x dot z, x1 dot z, x2 dot z, and x3 dot z, where z, lower I, is 1, 0, 0. So if x, upper I, is 1x. Okay? So you see, in order to talk about a notion of area, I don't need a metric, but I need a line at infinity. Okay? So again, normally we're so used to metric notions, we think all these things go together, but they don't. The notion of area is more primitive than a notion of a distance. Okay? And a notion of an area does not need you to break the SL3 symmetry all the way down to SO2. Okay? It's enough to just introduce a notion of a line at infinity. And then you have a notion of an area. Why? Why is that? Because the notion of an area is really capturing how far you are from having the points be exactly collinear with each other. Okay? So that's why all you need is something, and notice that this object is not rescaling invariant into rescaling z. If I rescale z, it has a weight. That's good because area has units. So everything makes perfect sense. But I have to choose to talk about an area. I have to choose a hyperplane at infinity. Okay? Is that clear? And then this is the formula. Right? This is the high school formula. Okay? Now, let me write this formula as an area just to make it look very fancy so you can feel very proud of yourselves. Okay? So I want to say that this is an area, I'm going to write this as an integral. It's an integral, right? So I want to write it as an integral over the inside of this triangle. So I'm going to write this as an integral with x inside the triangle, x1, x2, x3, of some form. What could the form be? X dx dx. It has to be that. And now, what does it have to be in order for it to have weight, the right weight in x? I have to have three x's downstairs. So this is another way of saying why I need some kind of some line at infinity to define an area. I want to integrate over something. I need to have something that cancels the weight in x. So it's just x dot z cubed. Okay? So this is the only thing we can mean by area projectively. I'm integrating over some region in x space, x dx dx, over x dot z cubed. I have to choose some reference line at infinity in order to define this. Okay? Once again, if I restrict, if I make the choice that I made before, if I put x to one little x and z to 1, 0, then this integral literally becomes integral d squared x. That's it, right? With x inside the triangle. So that literally becomes the area, right? That's what x dx dx just becomes d squared x. X dot z is 1. So this is just a fancy projective way of saying the integral over a region of d squared x. All right? Is that clear? Now, a little exercise for you. This looks like such a simple, nice formula. A little exercise for you. You know this formula by a different name. It's also known as Feynman parametrization. When you compute loop integrals, you know there's this expression, right? When you compute loop integrals, there's this expression that takes a bunch of denominators and it combines them as an integral of something raised to a power. That's a formula for the area of a triangle in projective space. Okay, and that's a little exercise for you to understand why that's true. In fact, Feynman parameters are really naturally projective. You know that because every time you calculate with them, there's the fucking annoying, they add up to 1, there's all that crap, right? Every time you're adding up something to 1, it's because there's something projective and you're choosing some particular coordinates to do it. The reason Feynman parameters are projective is that they're in fact Schwinger parameters, because he invented them, so there's that. But the underlying Schwinger parameters are manifestly invariant under rescaling all of them by a constant. Okay? So the entire construction is projective to begin with. Anyway, this is a little exercise for you to show that this wonderful formula is the same as Feynman parameterization. In any case, so that's just the formula for the area of a triangle, and it's to remind you, or to show you in this case, if you haven't seen it before, that the notion of an area projectively requires a choice of a line at infinity. Let's go back to our formula for the canonical form. Okay, so remember, if I gave you the vertices 1, 2, and 3, I gave you those vertices, the canonical form was z dz dz 1, 2, 3 squared over z 1, 2, z 2, 3, z 3, 1. Okay? And so this function of weight minus 3 that we're talking about is just this guy, right? So let me just not write it down again. All right? That's the function that we're talking about. Now, remember, in this picture, z is a point. These are points. Now let me draw the dual of this picture. What is the dual of this picture? The dual of this picture, z is a line. 1, 2, and 3 are lines. So in the dual, I have lines 1, 2, and 3. I have z, which is some line. Okay? Now you think of z as a line at infinity. Think of z as a line at infinity, and you ask, what is the area of this triangle? Well, we gave the formula, right? In terms of the lines, that's it. And that's exactly the area of that triangle. So you see, when I think of the canonical form in Z with Z as a point, after I factor out the Z, dz, dz piece, what's left is in fact the area, not of the triangle itself, which doesn't make any sense because I need a line to define a triangle. That's why I have to dualize. When I dualize, it's the area of the triangle with Z thought of as the line at infinity. And since that's true for the individual pieces, it's true for the sum. Okay, so that's why it looks like a volume. It's actually dual to a volume. And then there's a lot of fun games that you can play, because if you want to find a canonical form, you can triangulate the polytope and sum the pieces. You can triangulate the dual of the polytope and add the volumes. And these are different formulas. There's many different things that you can do to get the canonical form. Okay. All right. So now you know everything that you need to know about positive geometries. So now maybe we can just take a pause and I can ask for questions, or people can walk out. You don't have to be captive.